Welcome to The Stack. This week is a delight for those who enjoy beautiful things. We speak to the co-founder of The Modern House on their very first print magazine, plus the editors of Rake's Progress on their new book about modern Ikebana. And finally, we have author and craftsman Nick Carey on his latest book, Material. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, the editors of Rake's Progress on gardening journalism and their new book on a new wave of floral design, plus craftsman Nick Carey. But first on the show, I spoke to the co-founder of The Modern House, Matt Gibbard. They sell the most impressive modernist properties there is. Who didn't spend hours on their website dreaming of the perfect house? And now for print lovers, exciting news. They have a new print title, Modern House, which is out now. I spoke with Matt about what can we expect from the title and why it made sense to go for print.
The magazine is a natural extension of all of the other content that we do. I mean, we have, of course, our online journal, which is in effect a magazine in itself, and we do video content, and we have a podcast, of course, but there is no substitute, I don't think, as I'm sure you'd agree, for the tactility of, you know, and the tangible nature of a natural magazine. And I started my career in magazines. I worked at the World of Interiors from the age of 21, and Albert, my business partner, also did the rounds in design journalism as well. He worked at Wallpaper and The Guardian and various other places as well. So I think for both of us, and indeed for a lot of our staff, doing a magazine is such a natural extension to what we're already doing. It just felt like finally it was the time to do it.
And Matt, what is the format of the title? From what I can see, it's going to be a biannual. But will you sell on your website, or will you give it away to some of your buyers, or how is it going to work?
So the first issue, like anything, is an experiment in a way. So what we've done initially is decide to sell it directly through our own channel. So you can buy it on our website. We've got a new shop function, which is just a small, you know, shoppable elements of the website. And we've also sent one or two copies to, you know, to people well known in our network. But really, initially, the first one is just about seeing what the take up is, seeing what the appetite is. Can we make it work for us? And does it successfully continue that message that we want to put out? And it's really for us all about a continuation of that idea that good design does add genuine value to your life and to your well-being. And I think that this magazine is another strand to that narrative. If people like it, and if we end up selling a few copies, I think we will then expand it from there. And hopefully you might see it in, you know, certain bookshops, museum shops, things like that as well. So we'll see where it goes.
And Matt, I mean, you mentioned there if there would be an appetite. I mean, I think I can tell you that there's quite a lot of appetite for The Modern House. There's something that about the brand that, you know, people are connecting with. I mean, were you surprised? I mean, of course, I think you launched The Modern House. Was it 2005? Correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, it's getting more and more popular. What do you think? Do you think people are caring more where they live? They want to live like somewhere pleasant. And you know, when you go to your website, you know, every house is in a way special, right?
It's interesting because the process of putting together a magazine is about being an editor. And I think that we, Albert and I, have been editors since the beginning of The Modern House because, of course, we're making editorial decisions all the time about what houses we take on to sell. And that then expanded into, well, which people in our community living in an interesting way do we want to celebrate on our journal? And then the magazine, again, is another editorial decision. I think people like The Modern House because I think it takes them away from their everyday. It gives them an opportunity to dream a little bit about a different life. I think they get lots of inspiration for how they might want to live themselves. And I think, you know, clearly during lockdown, during COVID-19, I think people have had a huge amount of time to reassess their living environment. There's nothing like being you know, trapped in your own home to get you to assess its merits or otherwise. And it's been so interesting for us to watch how many people have visited our website on a casual basis, and of course signed up to our Instagram as well, just to see what's happening and to reassess their own lives, and whether that's to move elsewhere or whether it's to change things up in terms of their own interior. People just, I think they find inspiration in the houses that we feature, which is really exciting for us. That's what we want people to do. We want people to come to the Modern House, not only to transact very, very simply, but also to learn about how you can use design to positively affect change in your own home.
I think you're very right when you mention, you know, that people that go to your website, or perhaps they will buy your magazine, they're not necessarily, you know, going to buy a house, but, you know, they are getting inspired. I believe I read somewhere that, for example, you have a lot of kind of young people that actually enjoy going to the Modern House. And of course, not all of them are able to afford a house these days. But, you know, I think it does, you know, it does count a little bit for inspiration as well, right?
It's really important that. You know, believe it or not, I mean, we want people to actively seek out the Modern House who have absolutely no interest in buying or selling a flat or a house. That's absolutely fine by us. There is definitely an educational aspect to what we do. Again, if you're an editor, if you're a magazine person, you just love the idea of inspiring people. Great photography, well-written content. That is really exciting to us. And you're right, I think we've captured a new generation of design literate youngsters who just love to see what people are doing. The amazing thing about the Modern House has always been amazing. This is that we get to see what's happening, you know, in the design world as it happens. We've got a front row seat, and you know, we can see these projects taking shape. We often get called into projects before they've completed, so we can see what materials people are using, the forms they're using, and the way they're choosing to live. And that's really exciting. I think people recognize that.
Matt, a question. I mean, as you know, from what I can see, you know, the Modern House is doing so well. Are you having to live with a different kind of pressure as well? I mean, a lot of people wanting, you know, to sell their houses, because I know you guys price quality a lot. I mean, as you can see, no matter, you know, the size of the house, you know, there is a reason why the house is there. I mean, I presume you have to say no quite a lot, right?
We do, and it's a bit of a perverse element to our business model, but we do have to turn things away. We have to turn work away, which sounds counterintuitive, but again, it comes back to that point about being selective and editing. And unless we have a point of view, then it just becomes another generic thing. So unfortunately, yes, we currently turn away roughly half, 40 to 50% it is, of the homes that are offered to us to sell. And that's not us being snooty about it, because it's nothing to do with price point or location. It just all comes down to whether we think on an aesthetic level it will resonate with our buying audience. That's a very simple decision that we're making. So a lot of people don't understand that at all, and a lot of people take that very personally, and I understand that, but it's not personal at all. It's the fact that we want to do a good job for people, and we'll take something on the sales side if we think we can sell it. And the way that we're judging that really is whether we think it's going to appeal to our specific audience.
Well, absolutely. And Matt, I mean, who is your audience? I mean, we're talking, you know, there's a lot of young people, you know, checking out your website, but are there a lot of people that are outside of the UK as well? I was wondering, and if were any plans for international expansion as well?
There are huge numbers of people from outside the UK. I think that it's become very clear to us that Australians, Americans, Northern Europeans have grown up with a certain amount of design in their lives. They've grown up with the idea of being connected between inside and outside spaces. And I think they're just probably a bit more tuned into modern design than maybe traditionally we have been in the UK. Now that's changed a lot in the last few years, I think, but over the years we have sold so many houses to people from abroad. It's really interesting. But I do think that the UK's caught up, and perhaps, you know, part of the part of the reason for the modern house now really, you know, gaining such a foothold, perhaps beyond what was seen as a niche and maybe a bit more of a wider mainstream audience, is because I think that in that public consciousness, people understand now, I think, the value of design in a way that they didn't before. In terms of our own expansion and whether we want to go internationally, the answer to that is, at the moment, we've got a huge amount to be getting on with here. You know, we grew by 40% odd last year. We ultimately can't, you know, even service some of the work that we're getting and having to turn people away. And I think that's an amazingly great problem to have. But we want to see really where we can get to in the UK first, and then see where things take us from there.
That was Matt Gibbert from The Modern House. The first issue of their magazine is out now. And continuing with the art of great design, I also had the pleasure to speak with the editors of Garden, Plants and Flowers magazine, Rakes Progress. They have a new book out on modern ikebana, also exploring a new wave of floral design. Victoria Gager and Tom Loxley tells me more about how the ancient Japanese technique is finding a new audience.
We launched the magazine in about 2016. June 2016. It was about 2 years in the making. It started with an idea because we had bought a house with a big garden. We were we both worked on magazines. We were looking, trying to find a magazine that sort of spoke to us about gardens, design, all the things that we loved, including the sort of natural world. And we couldn't really find anything like it. So we looked and looked and did all our research for about 2 years, and then eventually came up with the idea of having Rakes Progress, which was sort of looking at it from the aesthetic point of view rather than from a more sort of practical and horticultural point of view, with, loaded with sort of information that we didn't know because we were enthusiasts rather than experts. And that's, yeah, that was the beginnings of it.
It was, you asked about the name, and the name was, originally, obviously, it began with a kind of play on the word rake, because we were about gardens and gardening up to a point, but we weren't, we thought we were taking a rakish approach to it. And the progress bit came because it did, and when we began it initially also had an element of a kind of journey to it, because we were keen to learn more about this world and to take our readers with us. The one thing we knew at the very beginning is that we weren't deeply immersed at the time. We weren't deeply immersed in the world of horticulture. So we weren't horticulturalists. You know, that world is full of people who've devoted their entire lives to it and have got masses and masses of knowledge. We knew we didn't have that knowledge, but what we wanted to do was come at that world from a different perspective, one that embraced art and the aesthetics of gardens, plants and flowers. So the Rakes Progress bit was about setting out on that journey, and then of course it has the connotation of it has meaning in terms of the world of art. Not that it meant that we were going to end up dissolute and in the gutter, like I think Hogarth's Rakes Progress, but it kind of conjured up the spirit that we had when we approached it as people who were learning as we were going along, but wanted the art of gardens, plants and flowers to be at the forefront of what we were doing.
It's interesting you've mentioned aesthetics as well, and that's very much what ikebana is in a way as well. And it's interesting, guys, because I got to be very honest, I knew ikebana from a very, just superficially, you know, I knew that it was kind of those smaller kind of Japanese techniques, you know. But in your book, it's so exciting. It's what people are doing with ikebana. I had no idea that there were so many kind of interesting ways of making an ikebana. So if you can talk about, I mean, what do you know about ikebana and how the idea for the book came about?
I suppose a bit like the way the magazine Rakes Progress came about. The book came out of the work we were doing in the magazine. where we realized there was this really interesting thing happening with florists who were turning arrangements of flowers into works of art. In fact, they were starting to call themselves floral artists, and it was a million miles away from, you know, your conception of a florist if you were thinking of a florist on a high street. And so we came at it from that direction. But a bit like I said, when we started out immersing ourselves in the world of gardens, plants and flowers, we were very honest and upfront. We didn't know a great deal about horticulture when it began. We know a great deal more now. The same thing was true with Ikebana, because if you think there's a huge amount of accumulated knowledge that you need to get your head around to understand horticulture, you can multiply that by a power of 10 with Ikebana, I reckon.
Yes, and it has such, because it's so steeped in tradition, there's so many rules and sort of regulations for traditional Ikebana that we couldn't possibly say that we are experts at that. We were just more, like Tom's saying, embracing the world, the new world of floristry, because it's a really, really exciting place. You know, as Tom said, this sort of new wave of artists that are taking some of those traditions and then, you know, turning it on its head, basically, and showing it in an incredibly modern way, which is why the breadth of the book looks from the more traditional all the way through to the much more sort of sculptural and almost punk artists that are producing Ikebana arrangements now.
The book, you know, we run through so many floral artists in there, but we began with a Japanese practitioner. But before you know it, you're talking about people who work, you know, all over Europe, North America, Brazil. There's a whole world in which these people are taking their inspiration from the ancient Japanese art.
And we're only touching the surface.
But there's reinterpreting
it. There's so many more artists. Just incredible. It's very, very difficult to make a selection, you know. So there's an incredible breadth of people doing it, and you know, this is the tip of the iceberg, really. So it's a terribly exciting subject, and one probably.
But it's the collision of that art that has been developed over centuries, with, as Victoria says, the very strict rules about how you do it. It's when that meets the kind of free form thinking of. And I suppose a lot of this came from the West, that the collision of those two suddenly produces this incredibly dynamic, interesting, asymmetric, sculptural, floral art that takes, that just redefines what you think of, you know, as a flower arrangement. It's something else altogether.
And there's a lovely quote on the book, I think, by one of the floral designers, Azuma Makoto, saying it is, you know, like a work of art, but it decays, right? So it's quite interesting, you know, the whole attention you do for something that, you know, it will last for a certain period of time. So that shows even more dedication, I find, in a way.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's where it gets really interesting. And in fact, Azuma was, we interviewed him for Rick's Progress in, I can't remember, it was 2017. And that was the kind of the beginning of our
journey.
That was our first step into this world. It was a hell of a way to get in, because he's an incredibly interesting artist. But that's where it began. And of course, the Japanese, you know, even the traditional Japanese art is very, very wrapped up with the idea that perfection, or what we in the West think of as perfection, is just a fleeting moment, that there's a whole process that ends with decay. And in the same way that there's real interest in imperfection in the Japanese approach to this as well.
Also, I think that the respect that using single stems and small amounts of flowers, that idea of respecting the flower that's going to decay, which is so much more interesting than having a huge bunch of flowers that mean nothing really, that are put into a vase. It's this idea that each piece has been picked and is respectfully picked and put in that place because of the art. I find that really interesting.
Yeah, and of course that completely chimes with where so many of us are at the moment in terms of thinking about the world in terms of natural resources and there being a finite amount of natural resources in nature, respecting what you use, not expecting everything to be perfect as if machine made, but understanding that a flower has a life to it that starts way before it reaches what we would think of as perfection and goes a long way the other side too. And it's embracing that whole stretch that makes it interesting.
That was Victoria Gager and Tom Loxley. Their book, Modern Ikebana, A New Wave in Floral Design, is out now, published by Ludion. Finally on the show, I spoke to craftsman and author, Nick Carey. Carey just published a new book called Material, Making and the Art of Transformation, in which he looks at what it means to be a maker. He tells me more about his career and the new book.
I'm based down in Devon, between Dartmouth and Totnes, and lived here for the last 20 years. And I have been a furniture maker for probably about, 30, 35 years, I suppose. And I have the workshop at home now. And these days, not all my time is spent making, just a portion of it. But in the past, it was the way that we made our living here.
I mean, this thing about being a maker, was it something that you knew you wanted to do from a very young age?
Yes. Well, it's funny how we know things on different levels or understand things on different levels. Looking back, I realized I always played around with things and I hung out with my granddad, but I also took it for granted. I didn't realize that other people didn't do those things. I played freely, I mucked around in my dad's workshop. But when I got to, I think it's when the whole academic machine began to step up energy, you know, when the expectations of what we should do got stronger and stronger. And I had finished university at that point, I decided quite strongly that I wanted to become a maker.
In your book, it's interesting, of course, you know, you talk about, you know, many makers around the world, but there's a little bit of a memoir in it as well, right?
Yeah. It comes back in. It weaves its way through, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Very elegantly, I have to say. Do you think, you know, I don't know, I've been noticing, especially even, you know, in recent years, I do think there's a desire for people to, you know, they look out for well-made objects from artisans like yourself. Do you see that movement or do you still think people are just going to IKEA? They're not perhaps as interested. Do you see a movement more in favor of the artisan or the opposite?
In some senses, it's almost like a trick question because I live down in Devon, close to Totnes. There are big movements going on around here, transition town movements. There's a lot of craft. There are a lot of makers. There's a temptation to think that what happens here happens everywhere. So on the one hand, I'm cautious. On the other hand, it's very obvious looking at Instagram, looking at social media, looking at what's printed in the magazines, that there's a much greater appetite now for the handmade, not just the artist. There used to be this division between art and craft. There was a notion of putting art on a pedestal and craft was somehow lowly. But there is definitely an energy going on now for making, firstly, for people for themselves, and secondly, a choice some people are making to make their livings from it. So I think it is gaining momentum, yes.
It's getting momentum, but at the same time, is it challenging today to be a maker?
Well, I can speak firstly from my own experience, and secondly, I can perhaps act as a slight mouthpiece for some of the people I interviewed. But I would say that, to quote Nick Collins, who is a very gifted and wonderful potter, that making is a lifestyle choice. You don't choose it because it's an easy way to make a living. You choose it because the wealth that you get from it isn't just in financial terms. When I asked Nick what he meant by that comment. He said, well, I'm free to talk to you now over a cup of tea. I'm free to design my timetable as I wish to. I'm free to decide to make what I want to make. So I think in a way that making is a kind of rebellion against the rather rigid idea of employment and fulfilling employers' requirements for one, you know, what output. I think to be self-employed as a maker is almost like an act of rebellion, an act of, I'm looking for another word, but let's say rebellion. And it's not an easy road necessarily, but it is an incredibly rewarding one.
No, I can imagine that it should be, you know, rewarding. Nick, perhaps, you know, again, from personal experience, you know, this year has been incredibly difficult for many industries. When it comes, you know, to craft and to the things you do, how much this impacted you? And I wonder if perhaps there's been negatives, but also some positives, you know, in terms of creativity, time to slow down and see exactly how you're going with your work.
I'm not the best example for that right now because my time has been taken up with getting the book to completion, and my own making has been very dormant through this period. But I was just writing an essay this morning for a magazine and reflecting on the fact that because of that, you know, all my courses have been cut, all my teaching work has been cut. And so I ended up making some things from home. I've kind of like, you know, our income is diffuse. It comes from cabins we rent. It comes from teaching. It comes from making. And obviously all of those were hit. So I found myself with time on my hands and I just made some things. I made some benches we needed in the garden. I made a bed we'd never had. And it was enjoyable just to make for myself as a client, which I never got the opportunity to do. I never make for myself. I can't afford myself. So it was, I suppose, it was just lovely to make with no timescale, make with no money ticking away. And I really enjoyed it.
That was Nick Carey there. His book, Material, Making and the Art of Transformation, is out now, published by Chelsea Green. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monaco.com or subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and SoundCloud. Before we go, a little song for you. Sound of Arrows with Beautiful Life. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time. It's goodbye from me.